Talk Line Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.
What are we gonna do with our children? What are we gonna do to show we care? How are we gonna be there for our children when they feel that life has just not been that fair? Good evening and welcome back to Masked Weekly Radio Show on Family Matters. Mask Mother Fathers, Align Saving Kids, Kids of all ages and all stages for all mental health issues. If you need a referral for a therapist, for an inpatient or outpatient program, if you need a referral for a yeshiva liaison, a parent group by Zoom or in person, please give the Mask Helpline a call. Our number is 718-758-0400, and all our calls are confidential. You can call anonymously, and we will give you those referrals. Again, I will repeat our number. You may want to jot it down for yourself, for a loved one, maybe a neighbor or someone you would sit next to usually in shul. Our number is 718-758-0400. And this week, starting May 1, it is Mental Health Month. So we are very, very happy that we have these shows every week, and especially now, hoping that people will tune in and listen to our program when we interview all these special licensed therapists, authors that talk about mental health every week. So tonight, I'm very happy to have with us my colleague, Talia Becker, who's a licensed clinical social worker, and she specializes in the treatment of eating disorders, depression, and anxiety. And by the way, Talia worked at the Robert Wood Johnson Eating Disorders Unit for 5.5 years, both inpatient and at the outpatient setting. And she is presently in private practice. She treats individuals, their family members, and she does groups. She uses cutting-edge techniques and, of course, evidence-based data to formulate the best treatment approach for her clients. So I am very honored to have on with us tonight, Talia. Welcome to Mask's weekly radio show.
Hi, yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for introducing me, and thank you to Mask for having me on your show tonight. I'm very excited.
So thank you, Talia. Let's talk about the pandemic. And everybody's been home for more than a year, and there are suddenly three meals a day happening for some folks that are home. And those that struggle with an eating disorder, whether it's eating too much or not enough or whatever their eating disorder is, I mean, there's been so many families that have been calling for both anxiety and eating disorders more this year than ever before at Mass. Do you find the same?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, of course, the pandemic, everyone's stuck at home, and a lot of people or patients or whoever it is, both men and women, when you have more time alone, you have a lot more time in your head. And there's this whole thing going around about, oh, the pandemic, people are going to gain weight, don't gain weight. So if you have anxiety, if you have an eating disorder, all of that together, can make somebody ruminate on their body and fear of weight gain, especially in a society that is very fearful of gaining weight. And like, there are a lot of negative connotations with weight gain or being overweight. So you have someone stuck at home thinking about their body, the fear of weight gain. So they start becoming obsessive. They want to eat healthy. They want to exercise. They're going to restrict. Maybe they start restricting and they start binging. So it really sets someone up for like a really, really bad mental health situation, and also for a really, really difficult time eating, especially if you're alone and you need help eating when you're with other people and you can't see other people, and that's what gets you to eat. That's also such a major struggle.
Yes, Dahlia, let's start with the definition of an eating disorder for those that may be questioning it.
Yeah, so an eating disorder is basically, it's a very serious mental illness, and it is characterized by having a severe preoccupation with your body, weight, engaging in over-exercising. For some people, it's eating and then purging. For some people, it's overeating and not purging. But the key point is to remember that it is a mental illness. So typically when we think about someone with an eating disorder, we think someone who's really frail looking or emaciated. But there are many people walking around who may not look like they have an eating disorder, but they do, because mentally they're obsessing, they're feeling really shameful about their body, about their weight. So I think that's so important to remember, that if someone comes into the office and they look like they don't have an eating disorder, to not dismiss it as not an eating disorder, because it is a mental illness and you don't always see it visually.
Absolutely. And for parents, it can take a long time for parents to recognize it when you have teenagers, because teenagers may want to diet, you know, peer pressure, looking good, young adults going out to get ready to date. They may be eating differently suddenly. So let's talk about, generally speaking, when does one or how does one get an eating disorder?
So, yeah, I mean, there are many different factors that go into the development of an eating disorder. It could be biological. It could be that someone in your family had it and through the genes it got passed down. It could be environmental. So basically, you know, we're living in this huge movement for diet culture and be thinner, and thinner is better, and thinner means you're going to have this awesome, amazing, happy life. So when you're surrounded by that, and now with social media being like at its height, it's literally everywhere. And even like we said, the pandemic, right, with COVID, if you're stuck at home and you're someone who thinks and overthinks, that also can be fuel to have an eating disorder as well. And in combination also with certain personality types. So if someone's naturally obsessive and let's say they go on a diet and they become obsessed with the diet, and that can turn into an eating disorder because their whole life is just becoming about losing weight. And I guess an example of that would be if a teenager was bullied for their weight, so their self-worth now is like intertwined with how they look. So they try to lose weight not to be healthy, but they try to lose weight in order to be liked. And that also turns into this eating disorder, that now their self-worth is intertwined with their body and with their weight, and then it gets super complicated from there.
Peer pressure is also a big factor.
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about the treatment and treatment for eating disorder. How does that generally look? You know, what does it look like?
Yeah, so there are many different types of treatment. I mean, like you said, thank you for saying that. I worked on the eating disorder unit at Robert Wood Johnson. So there's, if someone's extremely severe, there's inpatient where they're in a hospital, monitored 24/7, nursing staff, people like checking in, there's group therapy, there's eating together with other patients to make it easier. There's also an outpatient level where patients are sleeping at home, but they come into program from, you know, like 9:30 to 3:30. They get group support, they get community support. There's also residential, which is another level. I guess once a patient leaves inpatient, if they're medically stable, but they're still struggling so, so, so much with their behaviors, they go to a residential, which is like a fancy treatment center, so to speak, where they can also learn how to mentally cope with their thoughts and feelings about food. And also, someone can go to an outpatient therapist once a week. It really depends how severe it is. But on a day-to-day basis for a patient recovering from an eating disorder, it's a really, really painful experience. They have to eat. They're afraid of eating. They have to overcome underlying issues because, again, it's not just about the food. So it is a very difficult experience, but every patient who goes through it and every patient who comes out on the other side always says it's worth it. It's just when you're in it, it's really, really difficult.
And generally speaking, parents are always concerned first and foremost about kosher in a lot of these programs. Mm-hmm. So do you want to share about the possibilities and what your experience has been?
Yeah, for sure. Robert Wood Johnson and I think a few other programs, there was a kosher meal plan. They had a lot of kosher, like their cereals, or even they can, you know, try to find some challah v'sorel things. Like, they're able to work with the patients to make sure that their dietary needs are met. And if they don't have things like that, you know, you can talk to the rabbi and see if they could work with you. A lot of it is pikuach nefesh, so if it's really so severe, potentially some rabbis would be willing to work with that. But definitely there has been a ton of kosher food on the eating disorder unit at Robert Wood Johnson. And there's been other programs who have specific like residential programs, like kosher residential programs, where you can get those needs met as well.
Right. And Mass will be having them on the air as well in the near future. So to let everybody know that there are kosher programs out. So Talia, the one thing that I've watched over the 24 years that I'm doing MASC, over 112,000 families that I've spoken with and tried to help, be assistance to help guide them and direct them to the right programs with all mental health issues, whether it's addiction, molestation, whatever it may be, eating disorders, internet addiction, porn, whatever it may be. The one thing is that most people think that eating disorders is only, you know, affects females. I'd like you to talk about that, please.
Yeah, that's, you know, such a big myth. And it's so unfortunate because I really think it deters people outside of like a teenager or teenager's adolescence to really get the help. I mean, about 10 to 15% of males have an eating disorder, and there's probably more. It just tends to be underreported. Many women, I run groups for women between ages of 20 and to their 60s and sometimes in their 70s who are struggling from an eating disorder. And back then, they didn't have such extensive programs. And, you know, back then, mental illness wasn't okay. So many of these women are, they continue to have this idea that, oh, they can't be sick. This is a teenage disorder. This is so shameful. So I think it's so important to make sure whenever, you know, you see someone you think may be struggling or as a practitioner or whoever it is, that an eating disorder can happen at any age. It can develop at any age. It can develop as a teenager and go on until your 50s, 60s, or people develop eating disorders in their 40s, 50s as well. And it doesn't discriminate against ethnicity, against age. It's unfortunately all-inclusive, but many people in many different age groups can get an eating disorder and do have an eating disorder.
And how would you address eating with children, younger kids?
Yeah, so I get that question a lot, actually. So there's a whole movement now, actually, with intuitive eating. And basically they say is that as children, we are very intuitive eaters. Like, we know when to start eating, we know when to stop. And I think that kind of let your children lead the way. So I think as little kids, if they're hungry, feed them. And if they're telling you they're full, then let them stop. Because that's kind of how, with recovery, like, after they get a treatment, the goal is intuitive eating and to go back to how it was like when you were a child and there was no attachments to the food. The food wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It just, you're hungry in the mood for pasta, you ate pasta. And if you're hungry in the mood for chocolate or carrots, like, you would eat that. So there is a whole movement to go back to intuitive eating and really just let your children lead the way.
So it's interesting you say that. You know, a lot of people would say, why can't patients, you know, that have an eating disorder just eat?
Yeah, I mean, that's that one. Whenever someone says that to a patient, they're so infuriated. You like see their blood boiling. And yeah, you know, I always say, it's like, what, let's say someone told you they're afraid of heights and you told them, like, well, just jump out of an airplane. Like, you're totally disregarding all their anxieties about height. Like, it's not so simple. You wouldn't just jump out of an airplane because someone said just jump out of an airplane. So for these patients, it's not only about the food. Like, if they could just eat, I promise you they would just eat. But the reality is that they're not eating because of some trauma, some underlying, anxiety or depression or perfectionism or just this massive, massive fear of what's going to happen if they eat this food. So I wish it were that easy. I wish you could just tell a patient, just eat, and they would just eat. But it's really figuring out some of those underlying issues and then addressing those. And like once you start addressing those, the fear of eating does decrease. But to really just say just eat is so invalidating to the patient because it's not about the food. It's about all these other underlying emotional issues.
So what should someone say to someone that is suffering with an eating disorder if they do want to address it?
Right. So definitely, again, not eat, but how can I help you? Like, what can I do? Because so many times with recovering from an eating disorder, the patient needs to feel in control. So if you're like, just eat, you have to eat this, you have to go there, they don't feel in control, and they're not going to want to recover because so much of the eating disorder is feeling a lack of control. So how can I help you? Can I cook for you? Can I eat with you? I know this is so hard for you. When do you want to talk to me? Just, and also a ton of validation, because when someone's struggling with an eating disorder, they feel like nobody understands, because to an outside person, it's like, how could you just not eat? Like, it's like not breathing. But for them, it's obviously not that simple. So getting that validation goes such a long way. And anything you can say that makes them feel more in control and that they have your help when they're not alone is so important.
So Talia, wanting to tell us what we shouldn't say to someone that has an eating disorder.
Yeah, so definitely not just eat, as we just said. Also, to not say, oh my God, I wish I had your discipline. Because basically you're saying, if I wish I had your discipline, you're basically saying, I wish I had your eating disorder, which is like, you would never go up to a cancer patient and be like, I wish I had your discipline. Like, you're saying, I wish I had your cancer, which is so inappropriate. So I would definitely stay away from that. I would also stay away from, you're eating that, because whatever they're eating, whether you agree or not agree, they have an eating disorder. So anything they put in their mouth, they're, of course, questioning. So for you to add more judgment to what they're already eating is not going to be helpful whatsoever. And it's not really helpful to come and vent anyone's food in general, regardless of an eating disorder or not. But even more so, if someone has an eating disorder, leave your judgment and comments to yourself, especially if it's in regards to what they're eating.
So Talia, maybe there are those that are tuned in a little late. I'd like you to just name the different types of eating disorders, please, again.
Yes, no problem. So we have anorexia, which is characterized by a very, very low body weight, preoccupation with food, making sure they're losing weight all the time, and a very, very distorted image of their body. We have bulimia, which is also preoccupation with food and weight. However, patients tend to binge, which is overeating in a very uncontrolled way, and then they purge. So that can either be through vomiting, it can either be through laxatives or diuretics, or it could either be through going to the gym and burning, working out to burn a lot of calories. There's also binge eating disorder, which is characterized by feeling a need to eat and eat and eat uncontrollably, even to the point past fullness. Again, that's a very emotional disorder as well. And other eating disorders fall under the category of unspecified eating disorders, which can be a combination, or there's some anorexic tendencies, some bulimic tendencies. It will just fall under a different category.
So social media has really been distracting and disrupting and exposing so many kids to so many different negative behaviors. What are your feelings about social media and eating disorders?
Oh, God. I could go on for this for hours and hours. Yeah, I'm going to try to make it very short. Social media is so toxic. It can be so incredibly helpful, 100%, but I do find so many of my patients are always looking at other people with the thinner bodies, or even if it's not related to eating disorders, like patients will look how amazing that their parenting is versus mine. And only on social media, you really only get a tiny glimpse of what's going on in that person's life for like that 1 second. And for some people, they may look like everything is going okay, and it's really not. And also to really try to weave out the positive accounts versus the negative accounts, because the accounts that are telling you don't eat carbs, or, you have to be thin in order to be happy, like, that's so false. And we know that. We know that thinness doesn't equate happiness, especially because all the patients who are so incredibly thin who have the eating disorder, they're so miserable. So if you can, to like take a break from social media, focus on the positive aspects of social media, because otherwise it can be so toxic and also so addicting.
And by the way, Talia, there are many teenagers that are on social media for, you know, right through the night. They're not sleeping and they're overeating because they don't realize that they're snacking during the hours that they are on social media, and realizing the opposite, they're putting on so much weight suddenly. And other problems arise, you know, the ADD, the anxiety, the depression's kicking in, and that's becoming a big issue with social media and the young adults today. I mean, like you said, there's positive and there is negative. I mean, there's right. also cyberbullying, you know. So yeah. there's so much that could happen to young adults today as a result of being on social media. So we do need to watch where the young adults are, who they're following
For
on
sure.
social media. Absolutely.
Sure.
So mask always recommends that family, you know, that have their loved ones with an eating disorder be seen by a medical doctor in addition to having a therapist. Can you explain the benefits of that, please?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is so important. And I guess that falls under the category of what does treatment look like? So when you're recovering from an eating disorder, regardless of any sort of eating disorder, your body is probably out of whack, especially if you're malnourished or you've been eating erratically. So it's super important to have a medical doctor who's going to be on board to check your vital signs, to check your labs, because the electrolytes can be out of whack. You know, you have to check for edema to make sure that, you know, your body's not carrying too much water, which can be really taxing on the body. So having a medical professional is so important to make sure that the patients are medically stable, because recovering from an eating disorder, if you don't do it correctly, God forbid, so many crazy complications can happen. So making sure you do have a medical professional, that is, again, so, so important. So I'm so happy that you said that.
Very important. And by the way, I just want everyone to know that all the psych wards, there are waiting lists for beds. There are waiting lists in all the rehabs that, you know, deal with eating disorders because of the pandemic. So many people are anxious. They're stress sensitive. There's so much uncertainty with the young adults. And they normally would pour the energies, let's say, in their academic, athletic, extracurricular. And now they just turn their attention into their own appearance or their physical being or how they cope with anxiety and how they don't feel or do feel. And that's become a big issue. And even boredom and stress, Talia, right?
Mm-hmm. It's so hard. Yeah. So much
right.
time on their hands.
Yeah. And then also there's, you know, the heightened food insecurity that many have. And that also can then turn into something that can be an eating disorder. So let's just get ready to wrap up. What should medical professionals know in regards to eating disorders? From your experience, you know, having the groups and having such a connection with all your clients.
Yeah, I love that you asked that. I think medical professionals, especially ones who aren't well-versed in eating disorders, like, it's so important to get educated, because when someone comes into an office, and many patients have told me this, that they were so triggered by their doctor that their doctor told them, like, right off the bat, even if they came in for, like, an ear infection, like, you're overweight, you have to lose weight. They take it so personally, especially because in society today, to be overweight is such a negative thing. And that can also, like, completely turn them the other way, or to not eat or be fearful of eating. So I think for medical professionals, if a patient is overweight, to reframe it as, like, how can we work together to make sure you're breathing better, you're walking better, you're feeling better, right? To focus on those goals and not the weight, because patients feel really, it's a very, very, very sensitive topic. And to just talk to them gently. They're still a person, even if they're overweight, and they need to hear, you know, nice, comforting things if they want to do this, especially if they want help on their journey and not to feel so alone.
Yeah, it can be very lonely That is one thing that the clients do share in the eating disorder groups, of how lonely they don't always want to just feed them once, you know, their loved ones or their friends know they have an eating disorder. One more question, Talia. Once somebody recovers, let's talk about their aftercare treatment, please.
Yeah, so once someone recovers, you know, they're out of the inpatient, they're out of the day program, so they're probably seeing their therapist once a week, but if they feel really strong in their recovery, then, you know, they can maybe not have to see the therapist every week, but it is highly recommended that they continue to see a therapist every 3 weeks, once a month, check in with a dietitian once a month, maybe check in with a doctor every couple months, check in with a psychiatrist, because an eating disorder is about the underlying stressors in life. And we're all human. We all have stressors. So whenever those come up, the patient will have a tendency, kind of like an alcoholic, to go back to the eating disorder, to go back to the alcohol. So you want to prevent that. So you have a treatment team in place to make sure that the patient keeps to the healthy coping skills, doesn't feel alone, is able to verbalize, use his or her voice and not their eating disorder or their bodies to help them navigate through life.
And I do want to mention that if there's any parent that wants to speak with Talia, feel free to give MASC a call at 718-758-0400. And we'll have Talia get back to you. But in addition, anyone that wants a group for parents, for the client, for that they're struggling with disorder, please, please give them our number, 718-758-0400. Talia, thank you for being on, and especially, like I said earlier, Mental Health Awareness Month is May. We must keep talking about all these important mental health topics and working towards stigma-free. So thank you for coming on the air tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And like Rahoma said, you know, feel free to contact me, any support, any education. You know, we'd love to help in the process.
Again, our number is 718-758-0400. You can go on to maskparents.org. Please make a donation so that we could continue with our shows and our outreach programs. Also, you can listen to previous shows. And tonight's show, by the way, is in memory of Rivka Bas Yisroel and Simcha Shmuel Ben Moshe. Thank you. Have a good evening. Have a beautiful Shabbos. And always remember, hang in, hold on, and virtually for now, hug tight. Thank you, and have a good night.
To all New Yorkers 16 and older who need COVID-19 vaccines, we'd like to welcome you to get yours. It's your turn. Make an appointment today. Visit nyc.gov/vaccinefinder or call 877-VAX4NYC.
Because of the current pandemic economic situation, now is the best time to lease a car. Interest rates are at an all-time low, and you can lease with little or no money down. Each month, carmakers offer incentives to make leases more affordable. Chesky Wurzberger and Yitzhak Berger at Zoom Leasing will help you navigate the many choices and steer you in the right direction. Their customers rave that they go the extra mile. Zoom Leasing is user-friendly, providing the best rates, more flexibility, and exceptional service. Get a new lease on life. Call Zoom Leasing at 845-606-ZOOM. That's 845-606-ZOOM. They deliver your new car anywhere in the U.S. Please call 845-606-ZOOM. Zoom Auto Leasing, where luxury and service meet.
You can now take advantage of some spring April savings from Zoom Auto Leasing for the month of April. Kia Forte is $199. An SUV Honda HR-V, AWD is $229. A Kia Sportage AWD SUV is only $249. And a midsize luxury SUV Acura MDX AWD is $419 a month. And the brand new redesigned 2022 Acura MDX, better call for special pricing. Call 845-606-ZOOM. That's 845-606-ZOOM.
Thanks for listening.
Talkline Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.